Hello, this is something a little different this week to mark the passing of writer Justin Richards. I think I was shocked, as many in Doctor Who fandom were, to hear of his death. I then remembered that I had once met him and conducted an interview with a few other writers on behalf of the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance. And I also remembered that that interview was no longer online. So I've dug through a bunch of hard drives to figure out where it was, and I present it to you now. What you are about to hear at the start is the bumper for the Doctor Who Podcast Alliance that I believe was created by Siobhan Galichon, who is also no longer with us. And this was a sort of mashup of all the Doctor Who podcast title music at the time. This is 15 years ago, so things have changed a lot in that time. Anyway, enough waffle from me. I hope you enjoy hearing from Justin, along with Trevor Baxendale, Ollie Smith, and Colin Brake.
Scanning for audio.
For audio from Garrow.
Hello, Luke here from Tmudwup, and I've been at the Oxford Literary Festival today in a setting not unlike that of The Greatest Show in the Galaxy to hear a panel of Doctor Who writers talking about their latest books, and I had a chance as a member of the DWPA to interview them afterwards. Enjoy.
Hello, this is Luke Harrison from Tmudwup on behalf of the Doctor Who Podcasting Alliance, and I'm here in Oxford where I live for the Oxford Literary Festival, and we just had a panel this morning with four writers of the new Doctor Who book range. If you could just introduce yourselves and tell us the name of your book.
I'm Colin Brake. I've written The Good, The Bad and The Aliens.
I'm Ollie Smith and I wrote System Wipe.
I'm Trevor Baxendale. I wrote Heart of Stone.
And I'm Justin Richards and I'm the flip side of Heart and Stone. I wrote Death Riders.
Now, I'll start by being quite honest with you guys. I, like Ollie, grew up in the wilderness years, so my Doctor Who, the money that I had to spend on Doctor Who when I was a kid was all on Target books and videos, so I never really got into the kind of extra-canonical kind of side of Who with the books. So I'm kind of a novice to this whole area. So let me just kind of start by asking you, how did each of you get into writing Doctor Who books in the first place, and how long have you been doing it?
I've been doing it forever, since the universe was a younger and happier place. And I was a writer anyway. I wrote all sorts of articles and things for Doctor Who magazine and places like that, and a bit of other sort of journalism and things. And I worked for a while as a technical writer at IBM, writing user guides and on-screen health, and moved from that into design and other things as well. And at the time, Virgin Books were publishing original Doctor Who fiction, and you could send in a proposal and they'd sort of laugh at you and maybe ask you to rewrite it or something if they thought it had some potential. So I thought, well, I'll have a go at that. So I think I was probably suffering withdrawal symptoms from moving on from doing pure technical writing to managing other people who were doing the writing. And I thought, well, I want to get my writing fix. So I sent them in a proposal for something called Theatre of War, which they liked, and they got me to write the book, and that was in 1996, and the book came out in, no, I'm telling absolute rubbish, that was in 1993, and the book came out in 1994. Yeah.
Well, that's so true.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
Getting on 20 years.
Oh, don't tell me.
Sure.
I love writing to entertain myself and thinking up stories, and I love Doctor Who, so when Virgin, as Justin was saying, was producing original fiction, it seemed like a great chance to combine the two, and I did send in some ideas, which I got some really encouraging replies back, so encouraging that I tried sending in more ideas, but the replies that came back got less and less encouraging, and I fell out of love a little bit with those books. I didn't think they were giving me the sort of Doctor Who that I really enjoyed the most. So when the license went back to BBC Books and they were sort of starting fresh with Paul McGann Doctor, I said, right, I'll try again now. And I was lucky enough to impress the then commissioning editor, Steve Cole. And that was in 1998 when my first book came out, the James Good Collection.
Great. Holly.
Okay, well, I kind of stopped writing as part of my education when I was about 16, so moving then on to just kind of sciences stuff, I needed that writing fix, I think, like Justin said. So I started writing and drawing my own comics, especially during my gap year, because I was just working a 9-to-5 admin job to pay for uni, and decided I didn't really want to do that for the rest of my life. So I started writing and drawing my own comics and getting them printed up and taking them to comic conventions around the country, and they're quite well received. And luckily, I got to meet Doctor Who magazine a couple of times at a couple of events, and we got chatting, and they liked my comics, which were not even sci-fi, but they knew I was a big fan, and they asked me to pitch a couple of ideas, and they didn't really go anywhere. But eventually the storybook came around and they asked me to pitch, and I pitched, and I wrote up a short story quite far in advance just in case I couldn't write prose, but luckily they liked it. And then I got a gig on the BBC website, and Justin kindly enough read it, and I got the chance to pitch for a couple of other things. So yeah, so then that ended up in my first novel being Nuclear Time last year.
Great.
I was a script editor and a writer at the BBC. I was working on EastEnders. I was a writer on EastEnders, and I moved on from EastEnders to work on Thugs, the Saturday night action show in the mid-90s. And around that time, I'd been involved in Doctor Who for many years, and Justin and his colleague Andy Lane asked me to contribute to one of the short story collections, Deathlock 3.
Yeah.
That would be about 94, 95?
Yeah, yeah. You and Stephen Moffat were two people we took a chance on.
Oh, right. Good company. So that was my first prose work. I'd written episodes of Doctor Who and was probably writing episodes of Bugs by then. But that was my first prose work, and that led on to writing a couple of Eighth Doctor books for BBC Books, and it's carried on since then.
Great. Now, I guess, apart from you, Ollie, when the three of you started writing, Doctor was off the air, the fans were largely male and largely adults, and you were writing for that kind of audience, that fan audience. How have you found the transition between that and now you're writing for an audience that is young, mixed, and used to the current TV show?
I think the biggest difference is fitting in with someone else's concept of Doctor Who. With the Virgin Books and the BBC Books, there was a sort of a brand image, and certainly when I was editing them, I had a clear vision of how Doctor Who should be, but there was a lot more leeway within that for authors to tell their own stories and do their own take on Doctor Who, and that's been reined in. But as far as the stories themselves, I mean, there are some of the new adventures and the old BBC books, fewer of the BBC ones, that you wouldn't publish now because they don't fit the brand image. They're pitched slightly wrongly, or they're too adult in some way or whatever. But for the most part, certainly the books I've written, I think I was always writing Doctor Who as it should be on the telly as a book. I didn't experiment as much as some of the writers are making it more sophisticated with a small S, I suppose. So I haven't changed at all. I'm sure I have, but it's something that's there, but it's not something that's a constraint, I don't think, not for me anyway.
Also, I think that for us, not before me too, because he went back to read those Tardy books too, our notion of Doctor Who fiction is very much firmly embedded in those early Target books. Mm-hmm. The Target books were great. Those very first ones that were about to be republished, were extended versions of the TV show. I mean, we had a whole range, bless him, Terence Dix used to knock out quite precise,
transcripts almost of programs, and then towards the end of the race they began to get more extended again, and those books, those extended versions of what you saw on the telly, were very attractive. But I think when you come to write a story now, those are sort of in your head, so you've got a sort of TV adventure but with more detail, more character stuff, a little bit more flesh on it. And I think that's, for me, connects right from those target books, you know, those pre-target books from the 60s to these stories we're doing now.
I think we're on a wavelength. We were trying to tell a Doctor Who story that you would see, albeit in a very different form, at 7 o'clock on a Saturday evening in book form, as opposed to some of those Virgin books, which were Doctor Who as we'd like to do it if it was going to be on at 10 o'clock opposite Buffy. And that's quite a different Doctor Who.
I think that's where I struggled with some of the Virgin books later on, where you'd have like a 90,000 word novel which the Doctor appeared in it for about 5 pages at the end or something, and I couldn't get on with that at all. So like, just in the books that I write, I don't actually find any different writing from now, except that it's a slightly less word count, which is good. But apart from that, I mean, I think a lot of my books have been criticised for being very traditionalist, but that's because just a nice write a book, a Doctor Who story, as I'd have enjoyed on the TV.
Take it, that's a compliment, not a criticism.
Well, that's how I take it.
As I say, I haven't really delved into this world of Doctor Who books, but I do remember reading reviews and some upcoming stuff in Doctor Who magazine. I seem to remember your books in particular were talked about in terms of being quite high on the horror content. Is that, would you see that as a reflection?
That's toned down a bit now, because I'm not writing for adults rather than adults.
But the way we turn them down is not that these things don't happen. It's not that people don't eat wasps anymore in Trevor's books. It's how you describe the process of eating a wasp, if you want to put it in those terms, and the level of detail you can go to.
Yes, I mean, the Virgin books were terrific in their way, but they were for a niche audience, and Doctor Who's been given back to everyone. It's now more popular than it's ever been. They've got a whole new set of generations of young people getting into Doctor Who, so it's gone back to being a mass market, mass audience thing. And those Virgin books were very much targeted a very particular niche readership who had watched Doctor Who, who were now adult and had a particular taste. So they were fine for their time and for what they did, but we're now in a time where Doctor Who is on television again, is getting huge ratings, is watched by millions and millions of people, and so the books have had to adapt to that reality.
Did you read the Virgin books on it?
Yes, I did. I read quite a few. I think what's interesting is that I've never felt constrained by New Who. I've really enjoyed the BBC books and the Virgin books and things like Lance Parkin and Vampire Science. It's just, you know, it's a really cracking novel, let alone a Doctor Who novel. But I've never... What I was really surprised at coming into New Who was I expected to be reined in a lot more, but I think I really appreciated the kind of trust that you can tell the story appropriately, and if you're kind of confident enough in your idea, they let you do your idea. And I found a lot more creative freedom than I actually expected going in, especially with my first short story not having any aliens in it and being about a propaganda stunt.
But a lot of the difference, I think, is a lot of the things that we do pick up on are at the detail level. It's not the story that you want to tell. It's the vocabulary as much as anything. We're not going to have...
I think you have to turn down a bit of violence and things.
Yeah, that's right.
And a lot of goddamns got taken out of each time.
We don't have profanity and we don't have naughty words and you know, there are things that happen in real life that we just don't allude to. They're happening. But it doesn't, it's like on the TV, it doesn't constrain you in telling a good story and telling it well.
So as an editor, do you find that process is very much the same now as well? It's just you're asking your writers to take a different thing?
And it probably is, because I think as an editor, I was probably a bit prudish anyway. there are some things in the Virgin books which I, as an editor anyway, would not have let go through, just because I don't believe they have a place in fiction of that type that could, even if it's not aimed at, could be read by people of a particular age or outlook or whatever. So it hasn't changed an awful lot moving to the current situation, other than me thinking, right, told you so, I was right. And the area that we do tone down, I mean, there are some weird things that you have to look out for, like the doctor doesn't have a drink. I mean, he doesn't touch alcohol, and probably it's best if his companions don't either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas on telly they might easily have a glass of wine in the pub or something, and in, you know, my book Grave Matter, the doctor knocks back 6 pints of old something or other in the local pub while he's trying to get information and whatever.
Okay,
so there's weird things like that you steer clear of, but they're not going to change your story. It's just, you know, Martha has a mineral water instead of a white wine.
Right.
So
yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Gary Russell was saying in a previous interview that the biggest difference was the length, and actually it's much easier to make a story that feels like a Doctor Who story with the new length. Then actually Doctor Who is very much, especially the new series, is very much a short story anthology. I love writing the audiobooks the most, because they are that, essentially the same running time as an episode.
Right.
And it's very easy to make that feel like Doctor Who. But even with the novels here, you're kind of padding things. Because Doctor Who paints in very broad strokes most of the time. And actually, with the books, you kind of have to get a bit more specific and go more detail in the world building and stuff. And I can't imagine having to write a 120,000 word novel and how to make that feel like Doctor Who, because that's
the biggest we got to was about 80, 85.
Oh right,
yeah, but books were
so it was supposed to be between 75,000 and 85,000 words.
And how many episodes is that equivalent to?
But what we've pruned out from that is not the story. You're right, it's the
vines.
It's the more, almost the more self indulgent stuff.
Yeah,
all the baggage that goes with that, and what we've got, the same story, but that much punchier and
yeah,
quite possibly more interesting for the readership that we now have as a result.
Yeah. Some of you have written for audio.
Yeah.
Have you? And you've written.
I've written audio books.
Either of you written for audio?
I've written for audio.
So you've all done audio. What's it like? Is the process different? And then what is it like having actors that you've kind of watched on telly, kind of in your childhood, acting your material?
Well, it's cool. can't deny that. You know, I did a Fifth Doctor and Perry's Big Finish.
Yeah,
and it was extremely exciting. The Peter Davison and Nicola Wright were going to be performing your material. Mm-hmm. That's cool. I mean, I'm kind of lucky because I've worked in television for a long time, so I'm used to working with actors. Mm-hmm. And I have worked with quite a few well known actors and people who were in EastEnders as well. So I'm not fazed by actors, actors are actors. There's nothing weird about working with actors. Mm. When I approach an audio like I'd approach a script, you've got to find the voice for the actor, make sure the lines are sayable.
Mm-hmm.
Because actors do like an easy life.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot different to anything else, really.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mindset you have to get into as well for audio, in that, I mean, it sounds obvious, but the audience can't see what's going on.
Yeah.
And you have to find ways of explaining what's going on without having people say, oh, look, over there, you see that man just climbing the stairs, mm-hmm. wearing the red cardigan, and all that.
Yeah.
And so it's a challenge, and it's interesting to get around that and express the action in terms of dialogue, basically. Mm-hmm. The thing I like about audio is it's so quick. You don't have to worry about all that description and stuff, which I love doing, but it's quite refreshing just to bang out some dialogue. Oh, I've done 10 minutes already.
Yeah.
The first thing I did for Big Finish was Whispers of Terror, which was like the third one they ever did.
Mm.
And I hadn't got a clue how long it was going to be. So I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll write the first episode and then I'll read it out loud and time myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the first episode and I read it out loud, timing myself, and it was supposed to be 25 minutes. When I got to 48 minutes and I wasn't halfway through yet, I thought, okay, I think I'm approaching this slightly wrong.
Yeah.
I need a complete mindset change here to... So you have to tell a story. You have to be very concise.
Yeah.
Every word really does count, and every word will be heard.
Yes.
Whereas in a book, people skim through it. They might think they read every word, but they don't.
Yeah.
On audio, and somebody's got to say it, and people are going to hear it. And it does focus the attention much more. My mind, have you?
What I did find with audio is, because it's more of a collaborative effort with your book. That's your book, and apart from the improvements that a good editor like Justin makes, you're reliant on a lot of other things. First of all, the actors saying the lines the way that you sort of envisage or want them said, and sometimes that can be a yeah, that's not how I meant that line to be read, but you take it on the chin. And sometimes they come back and they say a line and you think, what a brilliant way to say that. And that's never in a million years occurred to me that that scene could play out like that. That's not how I envisaged it, but actually what they've done with it is much better. So that sort of swings and roundabouts there. But you are reliant on the director and the sound design and stuff like that. So sometimes it can work really well. And sometimes I think your script can be a bit let down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's frustrating.
Has that happened to you?
No. I'm not naming names.
No, obviously not. No.
But it's true about any collaborative process. Yeah. When you've got actors, you've got directors, you've got producers, you've got sound people. As soon as it's collaborative, you're going to have things that disappoint you and things that surprise you. Whereas if you're writing your book, you do get input from an editor, but essentially it is your piece of writing. So as soon as you're doing something that's in the board, you're going to have to cope.
You've got complete control over a certain scene. Exactly how someone says it or what someone says or the beat of that scene is controlled by you in the book.
Yeah.
I think with a script, there's other fingers in the...
Much harder. I mean, one of the best writers of TV I know is Stephen Gallagher, whose scripts are almost director-proof because he writes them very cleverly so that you can't screw it up. Now he wrote a number of the best Bunks episodes. They were brilliant pieces of writing because it was very hard for the director to blow it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an amazing skill. It's not easy to do.
What about his Doctor Who work?
Oh, I love his Doctor Who work.
I really enjoy the sense of removal, actually. The fact that there is that one person between it. I cannot read any of my books after they've been published because I cringe at every line, every page, because there's always tweaks that you want to do. Mm-hmm. And actually... when Matt Smith's reading The Runaway Train, I can go, oh yes, no, that was a really nice bit of description because it really flowed well, that particular scene. Or when Nick Briggs read Nuclear Time, I was actually laughing at the jokes in it because it wasn't quite mine anymore.
No, there is a distance, you're right. But particularly with the... Was Nuclear Time abridged or not?
No, it wasn't.
No, okay. No, because Apollo 23 hadn't been abridged, but I haven't listened to it yet. But the novels of mine that there have been versions of are cut down. It's very interesting listening to the Resurrection Casket, which somebody else, Jack Rayner, abridged brilliantly, and get to the end of thinking, oh, hang on, what happened to all those bits where this happened or that complete plot strand, but you caught up in it at the time. And Martha and the Mirror I abridged myself, which was much harder work than I expected, and it's interesting listening to something that is the essence of what you wrote, without being its entirety. I found that fascinating.
And just coming back to the books, we're going to wrap up in a little bit. Who have you had in mind when you've been writing them? Who do you think will appreciate them? This current batch of books that is just coming out that people have been having you sign at this event.
Well, these books are for Penguin Books, for BBC Children's Books, to see in print at Penguin. And they are deliberately aimed at 9 to 10 year olds. Is that about right?
Yeah, 9 and up. I think they're probably 9 to 12 is the bracket in Waterstones.
So that's your target audience. So I think in terms of your plots and stories, it doesn't stop you. It's about vocabulary and about being pacey, which is why they're called chapter books. They're in short chapters. So you're never far from a chapter break, which when you're 9 or 10 is really important.
So it's thinking of an environment as well that children will relate to. So mine's set in a funfair, which is something that children understand. You wouldn't want to set it in... this is where Ollie tells me, this is where his book's set. Inside a large, Hadron Collider or something.
I've seen
on the telly, some huge scientific institute. Yeah. It'd be more difficult for them to relate to. Whereas, a video game or a farm or the Wild West, then those are the sorts of places that you don't have to get lost in the description to get it across, because you need to crack on with the story.
Mm-hmm. I always write them for myself.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing where I just go, well, what was I reading at the time? For this age range, I was probably reading Robin Jarvis, which gets away with a lot more grotesque horror than...
He's got a new one, does he?
Yeah. And with Nuclear Time, that's for that kind of age range where, when I was 12 and I was sneaking in to watch X-Files and that kind of... I like that, giving the reader that sense of thing that they're sort of watching something slightly too old for them. I think actually the Matt Smith series kind of really does that. It kind of almost looks like you shouldn't be watching this because it's a grown-up thing, but it's not, and actually it's perfectly safe. But I like kind of putting that edginess in, because I know I really enjoyed that when I was a kid.
You can go, yes, I think you can go more grown-up than you think you can.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, within parameters, but yeah, in terms of the sophistication of the narrative and the vocabulary that you use.
Also, you have to realise that being 9 and 10 in 2011 is not what it was when we were that age.
Yes.
Kids are far more streetwise. They're exposed.
Streetwise.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, they're exposed to things, you know, things that we wouldn't have even thought about when we were that age.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different world, and so you can be more adult, because sadly they live in a more adult world.
Yeah, I think Doctor Who has a role to play in the fact that actually I think the whole series could probably get away with being a bit more gory and a bit more scary, because it's safe scary, and kids do have a bloodlust, and actually to provide it within a kind of safe environment like Doctor Who prevents them going out and finding it.
Yes.
Through less controlled means.
I mean, I know kids in primary school who are coming in and writing about having been watching Saw. That would disturb me. It does disturb me very much. And you think, well, like, if they were getting that kind of kick from Doctor Who, it's a much safer place. That's Oliver Sirk.
You're a teacher. Does that inform your writing?
It certainly helped with writing these books, because I was thinking of my class very much and being the audience for it. So,
have they read your stuff?
They do read it, yes. Those that bother to read. Yes, I mean, I did actually start reading this to them as the class book, which they thought was quite exciting.
Great. So, just to finish off, what's next for each of you in the world of writing, or whatever it is that you're doing?
Good question. I've got some Doctor Adventure strips that I should be writing. And not at the moment. Should be here. So that's what I'll be doing next.
I'm doing some Big Finish stuff, which I'm not allowed to talk about, and some BBC book stuff, which I'm not allowed to talk about. And in my spare time, I've just written a book, which I need a publisher for, any publishers listening, called Hayley Comet Space Detective. And I'm just about to start writing a book called The Wolfstone Curse. So you can guess where I start.
Yeah, I've got a couple Doctor Who things that have just been finished off that will be around later, and then I'm joining a video game development studio as of tomorrow to become a writer and producer, so we'll see how that goes. I'm really excited about that. I think that's after the experience on the Doctor Who games, that's really an avenue I've really wanted to explore and go down, and yeah, it's a great opportunity, looking forward to it.
Great.
And I'm writing something for Big Finish, but I don't think I can mention that yet.
Probably not.
And waiting for the next commission from those nice people at BBC Children's Books.
So lots of exciting stuff, and you're all kind of hopeful of more Penguin stuff, I guess.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah,
good.
Always, anything. Writing.
We'll write for money.
Yeah. Great, thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.